This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Well, welcome everyone to episode 64 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, Zachary Frühling. Today we'll be discussing Star Trek The Next Generation Season 6, Essential Trek Philosophy. Zachary, how are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. I'm podcasting from my new stand-up desk, which everyone tells me looks like a Borg alcove.
You look a little taller there. You look a little taller.
Standing upright, straighten out my spine.
Well, I am sitting as per usual, and I have to admit, Zachary, that this has been a tough week for me trying to choose three essential Trek philosophy episodes from the sixth season of Star Trek The Next Generation. The reason I had such a difficult time is we have covered so many of these season six episodes in past episodes of Metatrex. In fact, as I was going through, we've talked in whole or in part about Timescape, Second Chances, Suspicions, The Chase, Tapestry, Ship in a Bottle, Chain of Command, Quality of Life, and Relics. I mean, that's nearly half the season right there.
Goodness, I hope there's still something left for us to discuss tonight.
We may have to refer our listeners to our back catalog, because again, some of these episodes we've discussed in some substantial length, and I was just concerned as we were going down through there, you know, do I go back and do I choose some of these? Because after all, we're talking Essential Trek philosophy, and as I kind of cross-checked our Metatrex episodes with season six of Next Generation and saw the sheer number of episodes we've talked about, it's like, okay, do I choose any of these episodes again? And I ultimately decided that this is called our Essential Trek Philosophy. So I'm just going to go for it, regardless of whether or not we've discussed episodes in the past or not. My list is my list.
Well, I went a totally different direction. I was completely unable to whittle my list down to five, so I have no distinction whatsoever between my five picks for Essential Trek Philosophy and everything else on my honorable mention list. I just have a long list.
Well, I had a long list, but I did whittle it down. I actually have three and two honorable mentions, but I can go ahead and hang on to my whole list of five, and then I've got, well, just about every episode that I've listed belong on my honorable mention list. Because this is just philosophically rich content in this sixth season of Star Trek The Next Generation. I'm not going to say that Next Generation is the most philosophical Trek. I'm not going to quite go that far, but I've got to say, we talk about Next Generation a lot on our podcast for a good reason. And the sixth season in particular, it seems like, as I, again, cross-referenced with previous episodes of Metatrex. I mean, we've done 63 of these now, Zachary, and to have discussed so many episodes, again, in whole or in part, in previous episodes of those 63 episodes of Metatrex, it's phenomenal.
I think as we get further and further into our series on Essential Trek Philosophy, and as we get further into the meat, or the burned replicated bird meat of Star Trek The Next Generation, we'll find that it's harder and harder to take a season and whittle it down to a top five list of Essential Trek Philosophy, because there's so much philosophical content packed into Star Trek The Next Generation.
Indeed, there is. Now, just a reminder to our listeners about what we do here on MetaTreks for essentials. We don't just have any old essentials list, Zachary. We have an essential Trek philosophy list. We decided to do this a while back, and we have a few of them under our belt now. We decided to go in reverse order, so we started with Enterprise and worked our way back. And we're going also backward in rotation of seasons. So as we've worked our way through, we recently did the sixth season of Deep Space Nine. Now we're to the sixth season of Next Generation. Our next Essential Trek philosophy, approximately four episodes from now, we'll be covering the second season of the original series. So as we do our Essential Trek philosophy, you and I sit down and compile a list. We don't share our lists. We basically compile a list of what we feel are episodes of Star Trek that are essential for people who are interested in the philosophical content of those episodes. And unlike a lot of our MetaTreks shows, we're not going to discuss these episodes in depth. We're just going to kind of give an overview and talk about what themes in particular were interesting to us philosophically.
Well, Mike, before we dive in to compare our notes on Essential Trek philosophy from Star Trek The Next Generation Season 6, I wanted to take a moment to dedicate this episode of MetaTreks to a friend and former student and colleague of mine named Beth Ann Allen. I got some bad news this week that she had passed away, and it's someone I had first met back in my UC Santa Cruz days as a teaching assistant. And I have some fond memories of comparing notes on Star Trek and philosophy, kind of geeking out and talking about Star Trek and philosophy with this individual who became a friend of mine and eventually someone I recruited to come work with me at my old company, creating online homework assignments for logic and critical thinking and philosophy courses. So this was some really sad news. You don't expect to outlive your students and friends. And it's just, you know, it's a reminder of how short and precious and unpredictable life can be. Very sad news. But, you know, I have good memories of those discussions way back at UC Santa Cruz and good memories of doing good work together in philosophy. And I know she was a Star Trek fan. I don't know if she was a MetaTreks listener, but Beth Ann, if you're up there listening to your podcast app in the sky, this episode of MetaTreks is for you.
Well, Zachary, that being said, would you like to dive in and give us your first selection for Star Trek The Next Generation Season 6 Essential Trek Philosophy?
Absolutely. So again, my list is in no particular order because I was unable to whittle it down to five episodes. So I'm just going to start at the top and we're going to work our way through the entire list. My first list is actually Time's Arrow Part 2. The very beginning of Season 6 of Star Trek The Next Generation. And I put that on my list mainly because of the time travel paradoxes. In fact, there's this particular time travel paradox inside that episode that has bothered me. And maybe you can help shed some light on it while we're talking about it. Maybe it's an unsolvable problem. But the paradox involves where exactly Mark Twain's watch came from. Has this ever bothered you?
It has. It has. And I have no answer for it. That's been one of those things that honestly, I have watched this episode and this would be on my honorable mentions list, Zachary. I have watched that episode so many times, both part one, which is at the end of season five, and part two, which is the beginning of season six, trying to figure that out. That is a puzzle, an enigma that I haven't quite figured out.
Well, if you remember, this is the episode where they discover Data's head and Mark Twain's watch and a couple of other artifacts buried beneath San Francisco, and they've been there for about 500 years. So at the beginning of the episode, of course, they find Mark Twain's watch and they find Data's head.
Right.
Through the course of whatever happens in the episode, eventually Mark Twain ends up getting his watch back, going back in time and then leaving that watch there inside the cavern. So Yes. It completes this little time loop of the course of events of this watch. And if you kind of run through this loop again and again, you realize this watch didn't actually come from anywhere. It's a self-generating wristwatch.
It's right there in the loop because its origin is in the cave and its end is in the cave. Yeah, it's a puzzle I have yet to solve. It would have been nice it could have been a throwaway line in the episode, quite honestly, that would have at least explained where the watch may have perhaps come from originally or what significance it had to him. But it's almost as he closes the watch and he leaves it there in the cave. It's almost like he is consciously just contributing to this time travel loop.
We've talked about other types of time travel paradoxes here on MetaTreks, but this is an interesting one where an object seems to literally come out of nowhere because it has this object, the watch in particular, has no beginning and no end.
Yeah. And I'm fascinated too by the fact that, Data's head is reanimated, and
I think it's weird. I mean, we got to remember, after this episode, Data's head is 500 years older than his body.
Exactly. And there's a lot of other really interesting, neat things going on inside this episode, philosophically. The fact that, you know, here's an alien race that, in essence, is feeding off of destitute, sickly people here in this 1800s time period. And they're feeding off of human beings. And the crew of the Enterprise is getting involved in that. And there's a lot of really interesting things philosophically happening in this episode that I think merits its place on that list for sure.
Well, when you put it in those terms, it almost sounds like it could be, this may be a bit of a reach, but it could be a metaphor for anyone who stands on the backs of others. In fact, Mark Twain says as much in the episode, or he's used to a world where people stand on the backs of others. But in this case, the aliens are literally feeding on people who are sick or destitute or whatnot. And there are people like that in the real world who do that metaphorically, right?
Yeah, oh, exactly. Exactly. And you have to answer some ethical questions, I think, when you get to that, because again, it's kind of an extreme example. It's a metaphor, really, for something that happens in our own world virtually every day. And what's our obligation to protect and defend people who are exploited by people who are more powerful than they are? Again, this is an extreme metaphor. But I think it stirs some really interesting ethical questions that there are no easy answers to, but they're ethical questions that I think are important to wrestle with nonetheless.
I didn't realize for a long time that this was not a fan favorite episode, that over the years, I've kind of clued into the fact that this is not a fan favorite, that people really kind of don't like this episode. And it's always been one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation, oddly enough. Maybe not because of the philosophy, kind of, you have the time travel paradox thing. The whole episode could be a metaphor for social hierarchy or people taking advantage of others. Mm-hmm. But I don't know why people are hating on this episode.
I don't know either.
It's got Mark Twain. How could you hate on that?
That's exactly. I'm going to go out on a limb and say, I really don't understand that, because anytime you have a time travel episode inside Star Trek, it's always interesting to me. I like time travel episodes. I like time travel paradoxes. I mean, Janeway and Voyager going back to the 1990s, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy going back to the 1960s, or if we go to the movie era, you know, they're going back to the 1980s, and I love those episodes. In Enterprise, they went back to, you know, World War II era. Although things were alternate, things were different, it was fascinating to me because you get to explore these important points in history, and you get to do it through the lens of science fiction, through Star Trek. It's a great juxtaposition to kind of, look at the way future generations might look at past generations of human beings. I mean, what's not to love about that?
And honestly, Mike, who of us hasn't wanted a sequel to A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll take that. Yeah, Zachary, this is a great episode.
So that was my first pick, Time's Arrow Part 2, which means I can't count it when we do Star Trek The Next Generation Season 5.
Oh, is that the rule?
So you'll have to remind me I can't count it twice. Maybe I will. I'm a rule breaker, you know, like my grandfather used to say, rules are made to be broken. So we'll see. I may count it twice. So that was my first pick. What's your first pick, Mike?
Well, along the same lines, and for the ethical reasons that I mentioned when we were talking about Time's Arrow here, my first pick is Man of the People. Zachary, I love this episode because it really asks some fascinating ethical questions. This deals with an alien who, when he first comes aboard Enterprise, he is seemingly with his mother. We find out later in the episode that she's not his mother, that he managed to lure her in through romantic overtures, and she has become a receptacle for all of his negative emotions, all of his negative feelings, and she has died. So while Dr. Crusher is trying to solve the problem of why she died, Deanna Troi has linked with this man, and she has become his new receptacle. And so Deanna Troi, Marina Sirtis, ages through this episode, but she also becomes, you know, very aggressive with her emotions. And at the end of the episode, we find out that for all intents and purposes, he uses people in order basically to stay young. And he's justified all of this in his mind. In fact, he really feels that he is justified in his actions because he's an important person. And this makes him, you know, young and vital, and he's able to do his job better, and it keeps him alive. And so he's justified all of this in his mind while he continues to use people to be dumping receptacles for all of his hostile, negative baggages, emotions. So it begs the question: what are the ethical limitations of using people in this way? And again, this is something that I think is a metaphor for something we see happening every day in our society, where, you know, we talk a lot about bullying these days, and we talk about abuse. The way, for instance, I've dealt with in 25 years of ministry, I've dealt with, you know, abusive spouses, and the abused stay in these relationships for, you know, 20, 30 years, being, you know, mentally abused, verbally abused by their spouse, and in many ways become this dumping ground for all of the negativity and hostility. And so, you know, what are the ethics at play here, and what are the limitations, and when does it become exploitation? And so all of that gets dealt with in a lot of ways in this episode, Man of the People. I think it's definitely a Central Trek philosophy.
Well, this episode is a great example of violating the Kantian principle of not using other people as a means to your own end.
Yes.
Treating people as an end to themselves, not merely as a means. This episode is similar in some ways to the episode Sub Rosa from season 7 of Star Trek The Next Generation, insofar as you have a character that's basically using other beings, other people for its own purposes. Except in that episode, you get this sort of romantic overtone. Like you get the ghost character yelling, "I loved all the Howard women. I loved them all." And you don't get anything like that in this episode. In this episode, Man of the People, you basically get this character straight up using the people to, you know, as a dumping ground for his negative emotions to achieve his own goals. And it's I think it's more obviously straight up using someone else to achieve his own ends.
Indeed. Well, Zachary, we have the first two episodes under our belt. What's next on your list?
So next on my list is Rascals. And if you remember, Rascals is the episode where Captain Picard and Guinan and Ensign Ro, through a transporter accident that modifies their DNA, get reverted to adolescence. And we end up seeing, you know, childlike versions of those three characters. And for me, this episode is interesting because it raises the issue of personal identity. Their bodies have changed radically, but they have all of the memories and experiences of their adult versions of themselves. But you can ask the question, I think, of, you know, what is it that accounts for the consistency of personhood from the adult version of those characters to the childlike version of those characters? And even here in the real world, as we grow up, you know, I'm the same person I was when I was a teenager. And so I have different experiences. My body's changed. I have new memories and whatnot. What accounts for your consistency of personhood over time? Mm-hmm. And here you just get such a radical break. Like their bodies are radically transformed, but they have all this consistency and coherence of memories and past experiences. To me, that is an argument that if this is a plausible scenario, and of course we don't really know how the biology would work, but if this is a plausible scenario, it gives some credence to the view that it's our memories and experiences that account for our identity over time.
Yeah, this was actually next on my list as well, Zachary, and for all the reasons you mentioned. I love the fact that it really deals with this idea of identity over time. The thing that I really, and I have to say, the four kids who were cast as the young versions of Picard, Ro, Keiko O'Brien, and Guinan.
Oh, I forgot Keiko.
Yes.
Keiko's there too.
Yes, young Keiko.
Young Keiko, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So these four kids who were cast to play these parts really are what sold it. I mean, these kids were brilliant. And Isis Carmen Jones, she's the young girl who played young Guinan. I mean, she just kills it in this episode because she embodies all of that great wisdom that Whoopi Goldberg brought to the role. And this girl had none of the experiences for which to base that on. I mean, she just embodies Guinan perfectly. And we get to see these kids struggle because, not, you know, as adults, at least for Ro, her childhood was a painful time. And so she's wrestling with that a little bit. Keiko and Chief O'Brien, you know, Keiko just wants, she's a wife. She just wants to be held. You know, Chief, he's kind of weirded out about it. You know, his wife's now a 12-year-old. But the best part of this was the way the crew, and in particular, Dr. Crusher, number one, the way they're looking at Captain Picard, he tells them, I'm still the captain. I'm still Captain Picard, number one. I have all my memories. I have all the knowledge. I'm still me. But they don't see Jean-Luc Picard. They see a child.
I thought you were going to say that the best part of this episode is young Picard calling Commander Riker his number one dad.
Oh, I loved it. I loved it.
But as you were talking, another feature of this episode that strikes me as interesting, I've been in this scenario, and I think other people have probably been in this scenario one time or another, of having innate abilities and talents that you've either innate or that you've cultivated that other people don't recognize. And it's interesting to take someone like Captain Picard, who has all this experience and the respect that goes along with that, and put him in a totally different environment where, you know, someone who encounters him for the first time is not going to give him the level of respect and the level of recognition that he's used to as captain of the Enterprise.
Exactly. But yeah, so for all of those reasons, I think you're right. I think Rascals, first of all, it's a fun episode of Star Trek. On any day, I can pop this episode in, I can cue it up and watch it, and it's just good, fun Star Trek episode. But if I really want to think about the nature of identity, if I really want to be challenged philosophically, this is also a great episode for a deep dive. So great pick, Zachary, on my list as well.
Before we move on to your next picks, I think we should say that personal identity is something of a theme inside of this season of Star Trek The Next Generation. At least two other episodes deal with issues of personal identity. And the ones that come to mind are Second Chances, where we have Will and Tom Riker, transported duplicates of one another, raising even more clearly issues of personal identity since we have exact duplicates of one another that have been separated over time. So I don't have much more to say about that episode, except that it's really related to personal identity and it's in this season also. But another episode that I find related to this theme is Tapestry, which we have Captain Picard. What? Why are you laughing at me?
I'm laughing. For you at home, I'm laughing, laughing because these are my picks.
So the other episode in this season that seems to be related to the issue of personal identity is the episode Tapestry. And if you remember, that's the episode where Captain Picard gets to experience an alternate timeline where he didn't stand up to the Nausicaan and fight and didn't get his heart pierced and he didn't become the confident captain that we know. He became a junior grade, low-ranking functionary ensign on board the Enterprise instead of the Captain Picard that we know and love. In fact, we've jokingly called this Picard in Blue in episode 2 of mm-hmm. Metatrex. Way back in the day. And in this episode, it's interesting to think about how much a person's experience and surroundings define who they are. If you take Captain Picard out of his experience as Captain Picard and plunk him in a different environment where he doesn't have the rank and he doesn't have the respect and he doesn't have the experiences that he had, is he the same individual? Can he be that confident version of himself? You know, we see him trying to convince Commander Riker to give him a promotion and to find a command position for him. And Riker kind of rolls his eyes at Captain Picard. And it shows that, you know, if you don't have that history of experience and the respect and the achievements kind of backing up who you are, you don't have the weight and the pull that you might have had. And so it really does beg the question, is this the same individual? Is this really Captain Picard as we know him? Or is this an alternate version of Captain Picard that doesn't have all of that experience richly integrated into his being?
So Zachary, I'm it's really fascinating that you should mention Tapestry when referencing episodes of Star Trek from season 6 that deal with the issue of personal identity. Tapestry is next on my list of essential Trek philosophy because of that very reason. It deals with what makes up a man. Is he the sum of his experiences, or is he a collection of cells? And, you know, it's really fascinating because even though Q's involved in this episode and it can be argued that none of it was real, I still think it's a wonderful life on the Enterprise. And Q gives Picard a chance to live his life to some degree over again without the regret of young, impulsive actions that he took that he regretted later in life. And the result was he discovered that although his actions were impulsive, and even though to a great degree he regretted them, these actions were still a part of who he was. And at the end of the episode, they talk about, you know, with the tapestry pulling one thread out and the whole thing, you know, unraveling. And I think it's really fascinating. And I relate to this episode in so many ways because I have, I'm a messy person, and I have been a messy person for my entire life. And I've done things in my past that I regret. And I've come to a place in my life where I look back on many of the things that I did when I was young, especially in my teen years. I look back and I have so many regrets. And I watch this episode and it reminds me that to some degree, I am the sum of my experiences. And even though in life we often do things that are regrettable, those become a part of the tapestry of who we are. And if we can learn from those experiences and build and grow upon those experiences, we can really redeem those experiences, just as Captain Picard was able to take his impulsive nature. And it really is, in many ways, is one of the things that makes him a great captain. And without, you know, that gut for, you know, for action, you know, being willing to, you know, just jump into action, take that away, and he's just not the man that he is. And he finds that he's, you know, he's left to a life in a blue tunic. Although I think he rocks that blue tunic, but he finds that it you know, it's rather limiting, and he's not taken seriously by Troy. He's not taken seriously by the first officer, and he's stuck. And so now he finds himself in a place to say to Q, you know, hey Q, I want my life back. You know, all the mess that I made and everything, just give it back to me the way it was. You know, he has that George Bailey moment, I want to live again. And although he doesn't run through the, you know, the carpeted corridors of the 1701D, you know, saying Merry Christmas, everyone, there is this kind of George Bailey moment at the end of it when he wakes up from surgery laughing at all of his experiences and realizing that he really is the man that he is because of his young, impulsive nature.
Yeah, there's so much to weave together when we're talking about this episode. A moment ago, you stated that this episode kind of makes the claim that you're the sum of your experiences. But I think this episode maybe makes a slightly stronger claim than that, that you're the sum of your actions. You're the sum of what you actually do in your life. You know, Captain Picard, if he was the version of himself that didn't fight the Nausicaan, that didn't become a captain and ends up being a blue shirt, that is Captain Picard, but he's not even Captain Picard anymore at that point. If that's who he is, then he's Lieutenant Junior Grade Picard, right? And that is who he is, right? That's what he's done. That's what he's accomplished in his life. And so there's a danger because on the one hand, you want to say, well, you just are what you do. This is kind of the existentialist point from the 20th century, that whatever actions you do, that defines your life and your choices, and that's who you are. On the other hand, we have hopes and dreams and aspirations and skills we can develop. We have the ability to improve and change ourselves as we go. And if you do that, then you're that person who improves and grows and changes. If you're the person who doesn't do that at every turn, then you are the person who hasn't made those choices and will languish in some way. You know, and I've experienced this in my own life. I mean, I've had to go from, I've changed careers a few times. You know, when I was in college, I was the Zach the philosophy student, and then I became Zach the Radio Shack salesperson to put myself through college. Then I became Zach the philosophy teacher, and then I became Zach the Applia content developer, and then now I'm Zach the instructional designer, and of course now I'm Zach the podcast host, right? And each one of those experiences I incorporate into my identity. I identify with who I was when I was doing each of those. I throw all of myself into my very being when I'm doing all of those activities that I just mentioned. On the other hand, there are things like you, there are things in my life that I'm not proud of. And you can say just as much, aren't you just as much the person who did all those things as you are the person who did, you know, great accomplishments and whatnot. I think there's a danger because as much as we want to identify with our experiences and our actions and our choices, this basic existentialist principle, I think it's a mistake to define people entirely in terms of those, because we do have the ability to learn from our mistakes. We have the ability to make choices that improve ourselves, whether it's learning from past behaviors, whether it's getting a new skill, whether it's pushing the boundaries in some way to improve or, you know, move your life or humanity forward. We have the ability to do that. So while we're intimately defined by what we have done, every morning we wake up, we can still do something new and something different, and we can improve ourselves. And that's just as much a part of who we are as all of our past experiences. But I think there is this brute force fact that at the end of our lives, we will be looked back on as whatever we ended up doing in this life. And that's it. At the end of life, I mean, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I have a friend of mine that just passed away, a former philosophy student and colleague of mine. Mm-hmm. At the end of life, a sum of a person's experiences and actions and relationships defines who they were. And that's a bookend. At the end of that story is done. I think all of us get anxiety about that. We feel limited by our past experience. We are concerned about the future, and we know that there's an impending doom at the end of the story when the book will be closed and we don't have any more chances to wake up and do better the next day.
Well said. I have to say on a lighter note, just a couple of minor points about this episode. For me, this is probably the episode that really caused me to, at least when I first began watching Star Trek The Next Generation, this was the episode that caused me to question whether or not Q was truly a villain inside Star Trek universe, because he really gives Jean-Luc Picard a gift in this episode, and I have an appreciation for that. I like these sort of stories. It's a Wonderful Life is by a long shot my favorite movie of all time. It's just this wonderful opportunity to evaluate the sum of your life and really to be able to look at it, all of it, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and really say at the end of the day that you've had a chance to do some really great things. I have this wonderful opportunity every week to talk about Star Trek and philosophy. I think about all the years I've spent in church ministry, being a husband, being a father, and you know, these are amazing opportunities, amazing experiences that I get to have. And you find in life that you can't just take the good without the bad. You just can't. And at the end of the day, you can sit down and evaluate things and say, you know what, it's a good life. And that's kind of Picard's existential moment in this episode when he really realizes, you know what, I've had a good life. And the other thing for me about this episode that I have to say on a lighter note, this really made me hungry for a Star Trek series where I get to see, you know, the kick butt, take no prisoners, young ensign Johnny Picard. I want that series, Zachary.
Johnny Picard.
Yeah, they called him Johnny. Remember, they kept calling him.
I do remember. Yeah. I do like seeing Picard fight the Nausicaa. That's awesome. You know, every time Picard gets to flex his muscles a little bit, I do like that, because Picard's so intellectual, right? We know him as the older, seasoned Picard, you know, reading Shakespeare in his ready room. But we forget that Captain Picard was once young and he was ready to, you know, pick a fight with the Nausicaa to avenge his friend. It's interesting you had mentioned Q's character growth as a result of this episode, because, you know, over the course of Star Trek The Next Generation, we saw Q go from a threat to being an inconvenience and annoyance and a prankster to being something of a mentor for Captain Picard.
Yes.
In this episode.
Yes.
He's got something to teach humanity and teach Captain Picard, ironically enough.
And he does so in an annoyingly endearing way.
As only John DeLancey could do.
This was a really fascinating episode all the way around, and I can't imagine an essentials list without it.
Well, in the interest of time, and since I seem to be doing these in two pairs of two or multiples of three, I'm going to do two at once here. I'm going to cheat. I'm going to squeeze two at the same time. One is Ship in a Bottle, and the other is frame of mind. I'm going to pair those together as being related to a theme. We've talked about Ship in a Bottle before, and if you remember, that's the episode with Professor Moriarty on the holodeck. And at the end of the episode, they basically let Professor Moriarty live out the rest of his days inside this holodeck cube with all the visual representation, but he's essentially living inside of a computer simulation from that point onward, right? Sailing off into the sunset in his borrowed shuttlecraft, right? And this episode, out of all the episodes in all of Star Trek, might be the most clearly related to Descartes' skepticism of the external world. Like, how do you know that you're not in a dream or in a computer simulation or in the Matrix? You know, it's spelled out in a number of different ways in different science fiction franchises. Basically, starting with Descartes, how do you know that the world around you, the world that your senses perceive, is accurate, that it's real, that it's not just a fantasy, an illusion? And I pair that up with frame of mind because I think Riker is suffering from a similar delusion inside frame of mind, right? Riker, he is not sure whether his reality is breaking down. Is he really this Riker who's inside this insane asylum, or is something weird going on where he's really the Riker who's got this life back on the Enterprise and some weird, you know, alien intervention or science fiction thing is going on? Or is Riker really the crazy, insane person inside the insane asylum? So again, just the state of affairs with the world around you, whether that's real or whether that's part of your mental construction, I see as related in some way to Ship in a Bottle.
Yeah, and both of these are honorable mentions of mine. They were on my long list, although I'm probably going to get some boos here, but I'm not a big Moriarty fan, but I do appreciate the philosophical questions that get raised in both those Moriarty episodes.
What do you have against Niles? Is it because he's not in a tuxedo?
I don't know. I really don't know. There's just something, I don't know. It's superficial. I think it's the acting. I just never was a big fan of either.
I kind of did want Fran from The Nanny to be his romantic partner inside that episode instead of the woman who was
that
there.
That would have been awesome. Much more
entertaining. Can you imagine recasting that with Fran Drescher?
That would have been awesome. So, yeah, both of these were on my essentials list as honorable mentions. Frame of Mind is actually, honestly, one of my favorite episodes of Next Generation. For much the same reason that Far Beyond the Stars is one of my favorite episodes of Deep Space Nine. They really deal with the same question, you know, where Far Beyond the Stars asks the question, you know, who's the dream and who's the dreamer? This really asks a similar question, and it's just a really great thriller. I mean, just a Star Trek episode or not, it is a really fascinating psychological thriller that I can watch over and over and over again.
And who among us hasn't experienced something like wondering, like, wow, is the whole world breaking down? The world seems to have gone crazy. Is this really what reality is like? Or this must be a holiday program, or this must be a delusion, or there must be a computer simulation, or this must be a something, because this can't be reality. This is too weird.
Sure. And we all have days like that. I mean, you know, we have days
where... Yeah, mental breakdown. You're just basically describing a mental breakdown.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But we all
and who hasn't had one of those
days where we wonder, is this real? You know, this can't be. I've said this before. This can't be happening. And that's kind of Riker's problem in this whole episode. He's having these bouts of delusion, and then the delusion becomes, you know, ever so much more real as he goes along, and what's real and what isn't. And it's just a really, really interesting psychological thriller. I think Jonathan Frakes should have gotten an Emmy for his performance in this episode. It's really some of the best. Frakes is a good actor, but I really think he went above and beyond in this episode. This was amazing acting on his part.
Well, there aren't a lot of actors that can carry a one-man show. We know that Patrick Stewart can do that, right? Mm-hmm. But we get to see Jonathan Frakes essentially doing a one-man show in this episode.
I hope that Jonathan Frakes listens to Metatrex. So, Jonathan, if you're listening, this was brilliant acting. And I just don't think you get the credit you deserve for what you pulled off in Frame of Mind. It's phenomenal.
Hats off to you, Jonathan. Whether you're sane or delusional, we like you anyway.
We love you anyway, man. So, yeah, great picks, Zachary, for Essential Trek Philosophy. I'm going to come up next with, it's actually a two-parter. We had a few of those here in the later seasons of The Next Generation. I have Birthright, parts one and two. I'm going to slide those in there as one package. This episode had an interesting B-plot as well as, you know, its main storyline. And the thing that I love about this, Zachary, and I know you're going to appreciate this, Worf is a philosopher in this episode. I mean, he really comes to this colony. You know, he's going there to try to solve a mystery. And he gets there and he finds out that Klingons and Romulans are living together really essentially in peace and harmony. And he kind of becomes Socrates. You know, he's like Socrates in the stars. And at the end of the episode, you know, they're going to make him drink the hemlock for poisoning the minds of the youth, you know. So I know you have to appreciate the fact that we have, you know, Worf, Socrates in the stars here in this episode.
That's actually brilliant. And I'm embarrassed to say I never thought of Socrates when I thought of when I've seen this episode before. This is a new connection for me. And you're absolutely spot on right. Worf is being asked to, you know, commit suicide. Well, not commit suicide. He's being asked to stand there and get killed, which is essentially suicide for Worf, right? Worf is naturally inclined to fight back, all for the sake of teaching a lesson to these young Klingons that he perceives as having been led astray away from their true Klingon heritage.
Yes, yes. And
so what would Socrates' Klingon name have been? Something from the house of Moog. Generations from now, they'll talk about Worf as the founder of Klingon, a new movement in Klingon philosophy.
Yes, Worf is the Socrates in the stars. Well, Socrates is Klingon name. Socrates, son of Moog.
Socrates. Yeah, I never thought that you could pronounce Socrates with a Klingon accent. Socrates.
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 I love the way that Worf is able to go in, and these two episodes, he really turns the hearts of the young people. He really causes them to rediscover who they are. And so there's kind of an existential question that everyone in that colony has to ask to some degree. And in rediscovering, who they truly are. I love the scene where the young Klingon boy, I think his name was Tok, I think is how it's pronounced. I may have mispronounced that, but this young Klingon boy comes in after going on his first ritual hunt, and he walks into the banquet hall and he slams this, you know, this dead animal down on the table, and he starts to tell in a very Klingon way how he slew the beast. And you know, I that actor brought so much to that part. I mean, you really experience the thrill of discovery with him inside these episodes as he discovers who he really is. You know, what it means to be Klingon.
Well, I think we can all relate to this. We've all forgotten the art of making our own actions into some sort of epic, right? It used to be back in the day that all of society was woven up with and defined by these epic poems and narratives and stories that defined our place in the universe and with each other and defined who we were. And we've forgotten the epic nature of our stories. You know, when we talk about our accomplishments, when we talk about all the things we do and want to achieve and have, you know, all of the things we've done and all the successes, why don't we sing them? Why don't we tell them with more epic force than we do? Why don't we just make a resume? We should submit, if you're applying for a new job, you should submit us a poem, a song, an epic. But you forget that other people are the hero in their epic. I'm the hero in my epic. You're the hero in your epic. Everyone is the hero of their own epic, right? And everyone's epic has bit players, and everyone's epic has enemies and comrades, and, you know, but everyone has their own epic that they tell about themselves in their own minds.
Yeah. And, you know, I have to say that this episode gets some criticism as well, Zachary, because there are fans who watch this who say, you know, did Worf really have a right to go in there into the society in which Klingons and Romulans are living peacefully and, in essence, muddy those waters? Did he really have the right to do that? And I think that's a fair question. And so, I mean, you can look at this from that perspective. You know, what ethical restraints should have, could have been put on Worf to prevent him from altering this utopian society that they had built here, this little colony on this planet, and the peace that was forged between Klingons and Romulans? And so I think that's a fair criticism.
I guess that boils down to what exactly Worf's beef is with this society in the first place, right? It can't be as simple as, you know, real Klingons or true Klingons don't get along with Romulans, right? He's not against peace. That doesn't sound right. Mm-mm. But there's something about the nature of the personality of these Klingons that have been lost. They've been watered down in some way. But it's not watered down because they're getting along with the Romulans. Like, the Klingons have allies. They get along with the Federation now, more or less. It's not peace that's bad in Worf's mind, I think, right?
Well, the thing that I think they kind of focus in on, that Worf focuses in on, is that he's appalled that these young Klingons don't know their ancient stories. They don't know anything of their heritage. In order to suppress, really, to some degree, their Klingon nature, these Klingon parents and grandparents have not passed on those elements of their heritage. It would be like, for instance, raising a generation of people who know nothing about, say, World War II, or know nothing about, the moon landing. I'm thinking of these major contact points, you know, in our nation here in the United States, and even world history. And every country has these touchstones that are very much woven into the fabric of who they are.
And maybe even worse than that, these Klingons have let their batoliths rust instead of keeping them ready for battle.
Yes.
And it's not just the young Klingons, right? There are some old Klingons on this planet that should know better, right? They shouldn't be the one. I mean, yeah, okay, you can almost excuse the young people. They were raised a certain way. They don't know any better. But the older people who are letting their batoliths rust, Worf has a serious issue with that.
His Klingon identity is intrinsically tied to these things, these ancient stories, these weapons, this culture. His Klingon nature is intrinsically tied to these things. And so rusty batoliths and untold stories really in his mind has caused these people to forget what it is to be truly Klingon. And I think you're right. It has nothing to do. He's not there trying to say we shouldn't have peace, but he is there saying we can't really enjoy utopia and forget who we are.
All those rusted batoliths, songs unsung, targ hearts uneaten. But I think this is interesting because this raises an issue of what education should be. You know, we have a responsibility. I mean, the older we get, the more we have a responsibility to take all the lessons from the past and all the things that define who we are as a people and as individuals or as families, and pass those things down and help younger people take up the mantle, pick up the batolith, and make those values their own.
Indeed. Indeed. So yeah, Birthright, part one and two.
Who knew that the batolith could be a model for education? That's my new model of education, the batolith model.
I think we should market this. I think we can pitch this around the nation.
You think so? The batolith model of education? We could give seminars, we could sell books, we could, you know.
Let's do it. Well, Zachary, what's left on your list?
So I actually have another Klingon episode as my next pick. I have Rightful Heir, in which we see a clone of Kalos be resurrected. And we have to decide, is this the real Kalos because he has Kalos's DNA? Or is he a false prophet, a false god, a false Kalos? And again, it raises the issues of personal identity. He has the same genetic makeup as the original Kalos. He's fulfilling certain kinds of prophecies under certain interpretations. He identifies, he has all the memories of Kalos as told by the Klingon stories and Klingon literature and Klingon lore and Klingon religion. But in keeping with the theme of this season of personal identity, this is another personal identity episode. Here we have another Kalos that's been resurrected, a clone of Kalos with some of his memories and stories and all the DNA. But is this really Kalos? And this isn't a question they consider explicitly inside the episode, as they have to decide whether to recognize him as the historical Kalos.
Yeah, I really love this episode. I trimmed it off my list. It was on my long list to begin with. I trimmed it off. The thing that I really like about this, Zachary, is this actually was an episode that, I mean, we're talking, 1993. This idea of cloning, it was still fairly fresh. I mean, we had Dolly the Sheep, and this technology, this whole field of science was then, and really in some ways is still now to some degree, in its infancy. I mean, we've made great strides, but we're still really nowhere near ready to clone a human being.
Well, there's actually a deleted scene from this episode where Kalos first, the clone of Kalos first wakes up and people say, "Who are you?" And he goes, "Socrates."
That's awesome.
That one didn't make the final cut.
I thought you were going to say he opened up his eyes and went, "Bah." Dolly the Sheep. But again, here's Star Trek doing something that Star Trek has always been really great at, and that is take something that is front and center in its infancy and really start asking interesting questions about it. We did this in the original series when we dealt with things like prejudice and the rights, rights of women. Here we're doing it in The Next Generation when we're talking about clones.
This is such an interesting episode because it's not just about cloning. It's about cloning combined with Klingon mythology and Klingon mm-hmm. religion, all set in outer space, right? This isn't just a cloning episode.
Absolutely. This is a great episode of Next Generation.
I would say it's also related to issues of hermeneutics and religious interpretation of scriptures and texts, right?
You've
got prophecies that foretell the second coming of this Klingon Messiah for all intents and purposes. And now the Klingons have to interpret that. They go, okay, here's this being standing in front of us. Could this be what those prophecies really meant? And they have to take all of these things that they thought they understood and retell them and rejigger them to help them kind of fit with the facts. And you could say that this episode is kind of making an anti-religious skeptical claim that religions tend to be self-justifying. Every time a new piece of evidence comes along, they modify and change and reinterpret to account for the new evidence rather than just abandon their old beliefs.
Yeah, that's a great connection, Zachary. I didn't think about that before, but you're absolutely right.
It's like what happens whenever you get these cult leaders that come along every few years where they go, "Oh, I'm, Jesus reincarnated," or this, that, or the other thing, mm-hmm. "and I'm the Messiah now, come follow me." And, and they give this kind of convoluted interpretation of what everyone else believes to kind of justify whatever social structure they've set up, right? What defines a cult, right? So here we essentially have a Klingon cult. They have, right? They've got these people waiting for the return of Kalos. We have a Kalos figure that has emerged, and all of a sudden everything gets rejiggered just to justify this clone of Kalos as the true Kalos.
In many ways, there are a lot of similarities between this episode and the Voyager episode Prophecy, in which this generational ship of Klingons that are out there in the Delta Quadrant believe that B'Elanna's child is their Kulamok, this religious symbol, this one that was going to heal them and lead them to, a permanent a settlement. And there are a lot of similarities between these episodes. And again, some really great questions. I didn't make that connection before. So, Zachary, as we're winding down to our final picks, I'm to my last one. And you'd actually touched on it previously in the episode today, and I didn't bite at that time. But it is another one of those identity episodes, Second Chances, Will and Tom Riker. And I'm a Tom Riker fan. I liked his reemergence with the Maquis in Deep Space Nine. I thought that totally made sense. There was nothing far-fetched about his reemergence in Deep Space Nine and being affiliated with the Maquis. I totally see that as being a possibility for the Tom Riker character. My only disappointment is that they never revisited. Kira promised that they would get him out, and we never saw that happen. So, you know, poor Tom is still out there somewhere on a Cardassian penal planet serving hard labor for his crimes.
I think what I appreciate about Second Chances philosophically is the way in which these two characters, Will Riker and Tom Riker, are only slight divergences from one another. Oftentimes these personalized identity issues in Star Trek are kind of radical. Like you get the Tuvix characters, right? You know, it's this radical transformation. Yes. Or you get, you know, old Picard turned into young Picard and Rascals that we talked about earlier. But here we have an exact physical duplicate of Riker. We get, you know, because of this transporter accident, we get essentially two beings with all the same memories, all the same genetic makeup, you know, essentially two identical beings. And at that moment, it's very interesting. You can ask, well, which one is the real Will Riker? Are there literally two? Because they have the same genetic makeup and they have all the same experiences. And as they diverge ever so slightly, you can continue to ask this question, well, which one is the genuine claim to being the real Will Riker? And to what extent are they the same individuals? And when have they crossed over into being distinct individuals with distinct personalities, distinct identities, to where we're not plausibly saying that they're the same individual anymore? And I think by the time we see them in this episode, they've diverged enough where we can say, yeah, their experiences are so different that we don't, our intuitions don't allow us to say that they're the same individual anymore, right? They've diverged enough. But, you know, if you back up the clock a little bit, like, okay, a week after the transporter accident, have they diverged enough, or are they still two mm-hmm. Will Rikers at that point? And I think, you know, a week after the accident, you can plausibly say, yeah, it's just two Will Rikers. One's stuck on the planet, the other one's, you know, beamed back up to the ship, but their experiences are like 99.999% identical, right? So, but over time, as those divergences grow greater, you can see differences in personality, differences in temperament, differences in experiences, differences in ambitions, mm-hmm. to the point where they look like two distinct individuals. But it's a line drawing problem. When have they crossed over from being just two Will Rikers to genuinely two distinct persons, Will Riker and Tom Riker?
Well, and I love the portrayal. Again, you just have to take your hat off to Jonathan Frakes. I love the way he portrays both of these characters. They're similar, but yet they're different. And he brings that to the role. And I love the fact that there's this competition that's going on between the two of them, that they tend to rub each other the wrong way. They irritate one another. And really, they irritate one another, not because of their differences, but because of their similarities. And it really raises some interesting questions that, you know, I have to ask myself. If there were two Mike Morrisons in this house, in what ways would we clash? What aspects of my personality would I find annoying in this other Mike Morrison? I really think that's fascinating to explore.
I have a slightly different question, because for me, I'm actually kind of competitive. I like to win. I like to be good at things. I like to be the best at things. Mm-hmm. To the point where if there were two of me, I would want to be the better of the two at everything.
But so would he.
So would he, but he'd be wrong, because I would be the better one. I would make sure of it. Right?
But I love that in this episode, and so it's some really interesting stuff there. And I have to say, just another shout out for this episode, Mae Jemison, real life astronaut, popping up here in the Star Trek universe. I think it's awesome. Yeah, Mae Jemison was actually the first African American woman in space. So Second Chances, that was my final pick for Essential Trek philosophy. Zachary, do you have any other picks?
I do have one final pick, and it's only an honorable mention because it's a topic we've covered previously on MetaTracks. It's the episode Quality of Life, in which we deal with the question of whether these artificial beings, the exocomps, are sentient and intelligent and have rights, or whether they are merely machines. And we've talked about this in several different ways when we've talked about artificial life. We've talked about Data and whether Data is sentient and has rights. But here we have a non-humanoid being, these little, you know, cute little robot exocomps, like an intelligent vacuum cleaner, you know, like the little robo vacuum cleaners that, you know, if it's like, in my mind, it's like asking could one of those be intelligent because it has some autonomous behavior and, you know, seems to react unpredictably sometimes. But it's an interesting question, the question of artificial intelligence and what status we give those, whether we think they're sentient or not, or intelligent or not, whether we recognize them as intelligent, sentient beings with rights, like we recognize other biological sentient beings with rights.
Yeah, Zachary, I am so glad you mentioned this one. I had trimmed it off my list for the very reason you mentioned. We covered it in great detail all the way back, way, 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 way back in episode 11, entitled Fair Pay for Exocomps.
Fair Pay for Exocomps. That was over 50 episodes ago. Can you believe that? Just a side note, that is over 50 episodes of
Metro. Because it seems like yesterday we were doing that.
We've talked a lot of Star Trek and philosophy.
Go back in the back catalog and check that one out. We talk about, you know, is it possible for non-biological beings such as android robots or holograms to think? And we really delve into this in great detail. So way in the Wayback Machine, episode 11, Fair Pay for Exocomps, you can catch it on the iTunes store or at trek.fm/Metatrex. So Zachary, just a quick recap of our list. The episodes from season 6, Star Trek The Next Generation, are Time Zero. That was your pick. It was one of my honorable mentions. Man of the People was on my list. Rascals on both of our lists. Tapestry was on my list. Ship in a Bottle was one of your picks. Frame of Mind was one of your picks. Birthright was one of my picks. Rightful Heir was on your list. Second Chances was my final pick. And then you had an honorable mention, Quality of Life. And that, listeners, is Essential Trek Philosophy, Star Trek The Next Generation, Season 6. Zachary, any final thoughts?
Well, I think in the way of final thoughts, the fact that we had such a hard time whittling down this list to a small number, in fact, we couldn't do it. We had a pretty long list, frankly, speaks to how philosophically rich Star Trek The Next Generation really was. And, you know, I'm looking forward to our future episodes of Essential Trek Philosophy, because as we dive deeper and deeper, farther back in time in The Next Generation, in a way, the episodes get better and better. You know, Star Trek The Next Generation, by the time season 7 rolled around, had kind of petered out philosophically. We had a hard time finding picks for season 7. But when we were first planning Metatrex a year and a half ago, I remember sitting down and coming up with a list of philosophically rich Star Trek The Next Generation episodes, and season 1 was jam-packed with topics. I can't wait to get to season 1 of Star Trek The Next Generation. So these episodes of Essential Trek Philosophy for Star Trek The Next Generation are only going to get better and better and better as we really get into the heart and the meat of the Klingon Targ heart of Star Trek The Next Generation. These episodes are only going to get better, and these lists are going to get more
interesting. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, we had 10 episodes, Zachary. That is nearly half the season. Not quite, but nearly half the season of what a list.
Yeah, and the other half sucks philosophically, just FYI. No, they're good too. They just didn't make the top.
It was extremely difficult to come up with a list of, you know, I had five, well, technically six, because Birthright was a two-parter, but, you know, six episodes from this season of Star Trek The Next Generation, because there is so much good stuff just jam-packed in there. I was going through the list, and really, there's not a bad episode, I think, in the whole bunch. Our listeners, you just can't go wrong by going to the sixth season. If you want rich philosophical episodes, you just can't go wrong. You could almost roll the dice and pick any one of the episodes from the sixth season of Star Trek The Next Generation and see some really good, solid philosophical content packed inside of Star Trek The Next Generation. But here's a list of 10 episodes that are, you know, Mike and Zachary certified, Metatrek certified, essential Trek philosophy.
You're so right, number one. Oh, I'm sorry. You're my number one podcast co-host. Well, everyone, it's been fun talking about essential Trek philosophy from Star Trek The Next Generation Season 6, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week, so here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, to the journey!
Leola is a substitute for any ingredient he doesn't have.
No sugar? Leola root!
Yeah. No bananas? Leola root!
No coffee?
Leola root!
Saturday Morning Trek.
Roddenberry was very involved with the first episode. And for that episode, we needed to come up with the derelict spaceship. And as a result, as the brand new guy on the crew who had spaceships and stuff in his portfolio, I got the job of coming up with that ship.
The 602 Club.
Yeah, well, and also that X-24... is really what he could have become. It's what he would have been if he had never escaped from Alkali in the first place, right? So it's not only facing who he had been, but what his whole existence would have been like had he not been able to break away in the first place.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and now also on Google Play and YouTube. And of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of Trek FM on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of Metatrek, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can also leave us a voicemail. Look in the sidebar on the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, you can find us under the handle @trekfm.
On Facebook, just go to facebook.com/trekfm, and while you're there, check out the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. This is our listeners-only discussion group. It is a closed group, so if you click join, one of our admins will let you right in. Jump in on all of the great Star Trek-related discussions there in the Babel Conference.
And we also invite you to leave a rating and a review of Metatrek on iTunes. We'd love to hear feedback and suggestions for the show, and it's one of the simplest things you can do to help other listeners find the show. Well, Mike, when you're not busy reading the great works of the history of philosophy in Klingon, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Zachary, I am most active on Facebook. That's where you can usually find me. Also on Twitter, my Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm occasionally around Instagram. That is cmichael1701. If you'd like to read my blog on my process of publishing and a little bit about life, just go to cmichael1701.wordpress.com. And Zachary, when you're not sharpening and restoring your rusty batleth, where can our listeners find you around the network and on the interwebs?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek FM as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM's dedicated Voyager podcast, along with my co-hosts there, Kay Shaw and Suzanne Williamson. You can always find me in the Babel Conference if you want to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, @ Zachary Frueling. Well, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatrex team from Trek FM. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Shea Mutala, our Patreon manager. And we'd like to give a special thank you and a shout out to our three associate producers here on Metatrex. We'd like to thank Patrick Devlin. You can find Patrick under the Twitter handle at MagicDrop5. Kay Shaw, who occasionally talks Voyager with me over on To the Journey. You can find her under the Twitter handle at ChocoWeeble. And our newest associate producer, Kit Lofstadt. You can find her under the Twitter handle at MotherCat, and that is Mother with a zero. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.